Welcome to Soil Health Lab's Plug and Plant Podcast, engaging farmers, ranchers, and researchers in the pursuit of healthy, functioning soils.
Welcome to the next episode in the Plug and Plant Podcast. I'm Barrett Self.
And I'm Buzz Kloot.
And today we have an episode with Arlington, South Dakota farmer Jesse Hall.
Yeah, so we finally got to Jesse's stuff, and I'm pretty excited. I remember the interview, but, you know, with my brain as it is, I forgot some of the really good stuff. So I'm really excited for us not only to do the podcast on this, but also to do the video series. Yeah. I think we're going to have 5 or 6 video series, and I think Jesse is really, really articulate on what he's done. I think one of the things that I notice about Jesse is that he has gone from the progression of being corn and soybeans, going into small grains, then corn, soybeans, small grains, cover crops, and then adding livestock, not only cattle, but also goats. So,
yeah, you know,
he's the whole deal, and he's a young man, so it's exciting to follow what he's done. And I'll bet you if we went back now, we'd probably see something different.
Yeah, probably so. He seems very open-minded, on the cutting edge, willing to try anything. And that mindset's really gotten his operation to where it is today.
Yeah, yeah.
Buzz, are there any specific points that you want to let our listeners know about before we hop into the interview?
Yeah, I think one of the things that really stands out in the early and then mid part of the interview is that Jesse is really big on soil structure, and he saw his soil structure radically change when he started introducing small grains and then adding more and more diversity. So you can see that when he talks about not only sidewall compaction and trafficability, but also when he talks about soil structure and infiltration. And this is something that he saw. And he also has been able to demonstrate that his yields for the corn and soybean when he is growing them have increased, and he's made this pay. So this is not just kind of a theoretical thing. This is a real practical lesson in what happens when you start buying into this whole idea of diversity. I think the other thing that he didn't touch on, but I'll bet you if you went back to him in terms of his soil temperatures now, what you're probably going to see in that multi-species system, or that very diverse system, is that his soil temperatures at planting are going to be better. We know that he can get in quicker than his neighbors because of how much soil structure he has and how much stuff he has above the ground.
Speaking of the video series we have upcoming, this is some of the most beautiful footage I think that Joe Dickey, the photographer, videographer we work with, has ever come across, and his soils are very vibrant.
Oh, this is, yeah, this is cool. Yeah, I enjoyed that session with Joe, and I hadn't looked at that, but I'm really looking forward to seeing what that footage looks like.
Yeah, it's stunning. Before we hop into the podcast, I just wanted to let our listeners know that Buzz wasn't mic'd up during our interview with Jesse Hall, so we have re-recorded his questions in studio. So for anyone out there listening, noticing some discrepancies, we didn't want anyone to get distracted from the actual content at hand.
Well, we'll get out of the way and let you guys enjoy the episode.
Hello, I'm Jesse Hall, and I'm farming over in eastern Kingsbury County. I currently live on my mother's dad's place where she grew up years and years ago. I started farming back in about 1996. Dad gave up about 20 acres of land. That was kind of my start. And him and I have been farming together, you know, pretty much ever since, until he's passing here about a year ago. And Dad's basically the one that got our family started no-tilling here back in 1988. He was friends with Dr. Dwayne Beck, and Dwayne at the time was telling Dad about this new idea of no-till, and we were having some problems with soil erosion at the time we wanted to address, and that was kind of what we did.
So Jesse, what's your philosophy towards the land, and why are you doing what you're doing? So instead of going straight corn, soybean, and making as much yield as you possibly can and not worrying about the long term. What does this whole way of doing things mean to you? Why are you doing this?
Well, you know, we farm some land. You know, some of the land that we farm is quite hilly, and it's been farmed now, you know, since the late 1800s. And a lot of those hills over the years, there's no topsoil left. And so that type of impact is something that, you know, we have to deal with right now. And so I would, as we go forward, you know, I would like to address issues similar to that and what other issues pop up. So then whoever farms this land after me, whether it's my son or my daughter, you know, I can eliminate some of the problems so that they don't have to deal with those problems later. You know, it's nice to just leave it'd be nice to leave the land in better shape when I leave it than it would have been when I took it over.
Jesse, give us an idea of your typical crop rotation, and would you include your cover crops in that?
Basically, here we're in a corn, soybean, oat rotation. I used to do rye, but the profits kind of come out of rye in the last few years. The reason that I pick oats is we raise it as a seed crop, and then we started a seed cleaning operation now to where we actually have an air screen and a gravity table, and we clean it and then sell it as a clean product. And so oats works good for us. What I really like about the three-year rotation is that since we brought in this third crop, our corn soybean yields have gone up significantly. Our infiltration rates have increased. And when you raise that oats, it also gives you a chance to diversify your modes of action on your herbicides. So the idea is to try and kind of cut down and like water hemp particularly. What I really like about oats is now we have an opportunity to cover crop in it. And now the Jim and I are putting up fences, and this way we can bring livestock back into the system is just another factor which is going to drive that soil health. You know, I know I had gone to some other workshops in the past. They talked about that our soil doesn't have enough microbes in it, and then the best way to bring them back is to bring animals back into the rotation. But it adds a level of profitability. So here you're raising a third crop that helps increase all the yields on all three crops. Then you turn around, put a cover crop in it, drive soil health, then you can graze animals on it, then, you know, build a level of productivity back into that. And it kind of works, all, you know, it's basically a systems approach is what it is. And we've been experimenting with some different things as the last couple of years have gone on, and of course we don't have it all figured out, but I think we're getting to that point now where we got something that's going to work pretty good for us. The cover crops that I like best, I guess, for us would be putting like a rye, a turnish, and a rapeseed mix in after the oats. That way it's good for grazing. And then, you know, your brassicas will frost kill. And then the next year you got that rye that comes up, and then we can plant our soybeans into that rye. And it's planting, no-tilling beans in a rye is just, you can't believe the difference between that and just going into straight corn stubble. You know, the roots, basically, it's like kind of planting into a golf course. I mean, the soil structure is beautiful. Your infiltration rates are beautiful. And that early rye growth basically uses up a lot of that excess of moisture in those wet spots you normally can't traffic through. And it pretty much alleviates most of those little spots. Of course, you're always going to have some spots that are excessively wet, but that's just the lay of the land, and it's just the way that it is. But that's one of the – so I'd say that's pretty much my favorite cover crop.
Jesse, you mentioned trafficability, and I wanted to know if you actually find that you can go in a little bit earlier when you're planting with small grains, you know, the rye and the oats.
Absolutely. Yeah, rye, like I said, it's unbelievable the difference that rye makes for trafficability and then using up some of that excessive water. And a lot of people are concerned about using up that water, and they think that it's going to be competing against water in the growing season, which isn't the case. I've never experienced that problem. It's been nothing but an attribute, you know, for helping us get in there and taking away the excessive moisture. You know, the big thing is you got to get your rye in at the right time, and the spring growth is the big thing. You know, if you raise a small grain, you can plant your rye around that 20th of September or before. And in the springtime, you know, you can be planting in a rye that's 3 feet tall. And once it's that tall, it's really doing something. And when you go over the top with your drill, it just lays over a nice mat, you know, as basically a mulch, and it helps choke out all the weeds. It really works well. Another thing you could do is you could technically graze, you know, your brassicas in your rye in the fall, and then of course the brassicas frost kill in the spring. You could run your animals over it again and graze it once again, and then no till into it. That's another option you have. You could double graze it.
Give us a little bit of your perspective and your experience with sidewall compaction and how the small grains help with that.
Yeah, so when you bring a small grain into the rotation and then add another small grain as a cover crop into that, you basically make the soil very mallow and porous, and you take away that cement slab effect that you get. And, you know, if you say you're in just a straight corn soybean rotation, you're in a very low carbon environment and a very, very poor soil structure, even in no-till. And when you go and you try and plant the vat, you basically make a furrow, and it creates a sidewalls on the side, and those roots can't penetrate through that, and then they just kind of grow straight down and you get a mohawk root. But when you have, small grain in the rotation, those roots can actually penetrate through that sidewall, and it isn't as big of an issue. And I've done this. I've been digging roots and paying attention to this, and I've seen this small grain alleviate that. You know, a lot of people don't think they can make any money on small grain, and I disagree. You know, you might have to market a little harder, and you can do it. But the one thing you have to take into consideration is the yield bump you get on the other 2 years. And even if you break even on your small grain, when you look at the yield bump you get on your corn, your soybean crop after that, and also if you're grazing after your small grain, your profitability goes up. Even though you broke even the 1 year, you still make more than you would have in the 2 year rotation.
It's really interesting that you mentioned yield increase. We also found that with Brian and Jamie Johnson of Frankfort. Can you give us an idea of the yield increases on your corn and soybeans that you're experiencing when you stretch your rotations?
It takes a while for things to start working. I mean, you know, you can't just start no-tilling in 1 year and cover crop and expect that stuff to just start work out and be perfect year one. But after 3 years, you're going to start seeing a difference. And I would say within a 3 year span, my soybean yields probably went up 3 to 5 bushel an acre across the farm average, and corn 10 to 12. I would have to say that's maybe being, I mean, that's right in there, and that's pretty, been pretty consistent.
Okay, this is kind of off the beaten track, but you have a history with SDSU and working out there. Can you briefly tell us a little bit about your experience at SDSU?
Yeah, so I worked at SDSU from about, I started part-time when I was 16 to 94, and I worked there basically full-time all the way through till 2014. And I had a lot of jobs over the years working on different breeding programs and crop performance testing. But my last job where I got into the soil health was with Dr. Sexton. That, of course, I got in contact with Dwayne Beck. And then we were part of the SARE program, which is the Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education program, where we flew around the country and went to all these different soil health events. And saw a lot of interesting things, met a lot of very interesting people, but what put me in a unique position was we would go to these meetings, but then we would come back to South Dakota and actually do the experiments, and then we would watch these experiments progress as the summer went by. And I have to admit, I was a little bit of a skeptic at first, but after seeing the difference that this makes, I was just sold on it, and I brought it home to the farm. And you want like a specific story? Just to give you one example, in 2013, there was a grazing study that was done. It wasn't my study, but I helped out a little bit with it. But we planted oats into some soybean stubble, and they put up a poly wire, and they mob grazed it. And then what they did is behind the cattle, they went through after they ate the oats down, and then they put in a warm season mix. And by the time that when the cattle got to the end of the plot, they brought them back and ran them through a second time. And the gains worked out really well. It worked out as a really good system. But the next year, Peter and I were driving down to work one morning, and he said to me, I want you to go out into this one plot where we had the cattle last year. I want you to take some notes. But I want you just to walk out there and just take notes, but I'm not going to tell you what you see. I was really curious as to what I was supposed to be looking for. And as I walked through the plot, I found two perfect rectangles of just pure solid weeds, and it was all grass weeds. And so I went and I told Peter what I had saw, and he told me, yeah, he says, what you're seeing is where we fenced it off and didn't allow the cow trap to go through, but we hate it. So the cattle basically ran through the rest of the field and mob grazed, and they weren't allowed to travel through this. And where the cattle weren't allowed to travel, this is in corn, sorry, I say that, it's in Roundup corn, was this pure weeds, and it was clean as can be where the cattle had grazed. And so we took a soil penetrometer and took penetrometer ratings just to see if there was any compaction, and there was basically is all non-significant. There is no compaction whatsoever. And after that, I become a believer in this stuff. And there's something to all this. And we took biomasses too, and there was 1,100 pounds of weed biomass where the cattle hadn't grazed, and then basically nothing, you know, where they did graze. So that's just one component of the system, and it's amazing the difference that it makes.
I'd like you to explain to me some of your field history, because obviously the system you use now isn't what you started off with. Would you be able to backtrack and tell us how you started and give me the progression to where you've been stacking one thing on top of the other? Because that's really important. And don't leave out the tough stuff here.
So in 1988 was the first year that we no-tilled. So 1987 essentially was the very last year that we did tillage across the whole farm. And over the years, on the wet years particularly, you know, we would really, really struggle with wet spots, you know. And we were basically a corn-soybean rotation. And occasionally we'd throw in an oat or a winter wheat or something like that. But it was predominantly corn-soybean. So what we did is we would get the chisel plow out, and we'd chisel plow all the low areas out, and then we'd field cultivate in the spring, and we thought, well, we've got all these wet spots, so this will fix it. Well, you'd get in and you'd plant it, and then you know, it would flood out on you again, and it never did us any good. So then we decided, okay, well, we're going to try a rotary hoe. So we go out and then we'd rotary hoe the fields in all these wet spots, and basically that dried it out, and that worked a little better, but then that planted every weed seed that was on top of the ground, and then you had a mess. Well, in about 2000, probably 13 or 14, we switched over to a basically a permanent three-way rotation where we brought oats back in. So once we started to our three-way rotation, a lot of those wet spots went away. You know, there's a few areas, maybe acre patches or so here and there, that were always borderline planting. I mean, you'd go through good conditions and you kind of slop through those low spots and you'd get to the other end. And then those low spots never really recovered. A lot of those spots went away. And occasionally, you know, you'll get a spot that's just going to be wet, just be the way the lay of the land is. And so now what we're doing is we tiled some of those areas and we're trying that out. And in some of the areas where we can't tile or decide not to tile, we're actually putting that back to grass. We're going to put up poly wires and we're going to start grazing in those areas. And, you know, it's nice because you don't have to have that investment you have on tile. And we're just going to kind of have a comparison, see where the profitability sits on that. You know, the take-home message is you got to give stuff time. And if you're currently not a no-tiller, the big thing that you want to do is don't switch the whole farm over to no-till all in 1 year. Just go field by field, let it be a progressive thing. But if you bring in small grain and start cover cropping, you're going to get your soil structure much faster, and you're going to start seeing your soil turning around much faster. And if you bring livestock and cover crops into it, it's just going to accelerate that whole process even more so. So instead of being 3 to 5 years, you might start seeing a difference maybe sooner than that.
JC, can you tell us how many animals you own and how that works in your system?
Jim's really the reason I got into livestock, because, you know, he'd come over here and we'd be working together, and after, you know, seeing some of the studies and seeing that the animal impact, what that does to the soil, I don't have a lot of experience with livestock. I don't know much about it. I haven't really been around it. You know, we got out of livestock back in the 80s and never really got back in. We were just been grain farmers ever since. And Jim has had, you know, quite a little experience with it. And so he'd sit down and he'd start going through all these ideas, and he'd say, well, you know, there's producers that try this and there's producers that try that, and this seems to work. And of course, it's different for everybody. Everybody's situation is different. And that's where, you know, it's nice to have Jim, because, you know, he sees a lot of different things and everybody tries different things, and it kind of helps you tailor a system that works for you. Well, anyway, we decide we're going to experiment a little bit here a couple years ago. And so we put up some poly wires and we brought some goats over, and we bought 10 bred heifers, or 10 heifers. Then we had a friend of mine brought over a couple heifers, and he put his bull out there, and that's kind of how we worked out the deal there. And we did some mob grazing that year, and it was amazing. Like, I really enjoyed that. It was fun going out there, and you know, we'd move the fence about every 3 days. You know, we figured out the prescription, you know, for the amount of cattle and how much space we had to give them. But I enjoyed going out and checking on the cattle, filling their waters, and it was kind of fun as they progressed through the system. And then we could see the impact that had on the land. And I basically, you know, we went 50-50 on the cattle, and then the goats. I've got 5 goats. I'm just getting into it. Just figured I'll just kind of dip my toe in the water, start out slow and small, and until I get enough experience where I'm comfortable to maybe start doing a little bit more.
Now, a lot of guys around you don't have any livestock. So what advice would you give to someone who doesn't have livestock and doesn't necessarily want to bother getting too deep into that?
Yeah, actually, that's what one of the plans that we had was, you know, the fences that we're putting up isn't necessarily solely for us. You know, one nice thing is there's a lot of guys that are, you know, pasture's kind of hard to find around here, good pasture especially. And one of the ideas that we had is we put this fence up, you know, we can use it, and if not, then somebody else can come in and custom graze it, and then that's just another level of productivity that we can have. And so now we're putting these fences up, and we're having pasture taps in there. I think that's going to be a really nice selling point to try and bring somebody in if we choose not to have the cattle ourselves. Yeah, so anyways, initially Jim and I decided that, okay, you know, we're going to buy some heifers. We're going to start out small, and if it doesn't work, we'll lose money on a small scale, but let's just try it. So sometimes the scariest part is just trying it. So I guess my advice to somebody, don't be afraid of it. Try it on a small scale. It's like anything, you know, do it on 5-10 acres. Try 3 to 5 cattle. It's not that much work. It's not going to take that much of your time. And it's enough to where you can, it's enough where you can kind of figure out what you're doing, and it'll give you an idea whether or not you like it.
Well, it seems to me that goats are really unusual in the system, and yet you guys have been pretty successful with goats, especially mixing them in with the cows. What is it that you liked about the goats, and what tricks did you have to use to make sure that the goats were successful in the system?
The nice thing about goats is that if they get out, if you're giving them a little bit of a treat, like a bucket of grain a day, they'll follow you into a fire if you've got that bucket of grain. If they get out, they'll go right back in. They could care less about freedom. You know, they want their treats. But what's unique about mixing goats and cattle together that I noticed, the cattle will eat certain things and not others, and the goats will slick up the rest. We actually watch the goats eat bull thistle. They will go up to a bull thistle and they'll strip that thing down to just a stick sticking up, and there's nothing left. And so we were experimenting, trying maybe a little bit of organic stuff, so we couldn't spray, and we had a lot of sow thistle, a lot of bull thistle, a lot of different weeds out there, lamb's quarter. I think that pretty much covers it. Water hemp. We actually sent in a relative feed value on it, and surprisingly, all those weeds weren't half bad feed. But the cattle went through and they kind of ate what they wanted to eat, and the goats come through and they slicked up all the rest, and when it come to the end of it all, their gains were just dead spot on what you wanted a bred heifer to be. I mean, I don't have a lot of experience with it, but all the guys I talked to that raise bred heifers told me, wow, that actually worked out pretty well. We didn't really have much problem with them getting out. You know, we were using a lot of poly wires. I think everything got out twice, and it basically, you know, maybe a tree branch fell on it, or some, you know, some deal like that that caused them to get out. But you know, their feed efficiencies are really good.
JC, you're really solidly in the East River part of South Dakota. Do you have any last thoughts that you'd like to share with your colleagues and farmers?
Yeah, I mean, if I was to give anybody, you know, any advice, and you don't be afraid to try something, but you need to know, experiment on a small scale, but when you experiment, do it right. Because a lot of people, when they experiment, they try it in the wrong way and it fails, and then they give up on it. And I can give you an example of this just to kind of help out. I, I've heard this story when I was working extension at SDSU many times, where a fellow would say, well, I tried no-till once and that didn't work. I had this wet spot way down in the bottom of my hill and I couldn't get in there to work it. And I had this neighbor that he no-tills, and I thought, well, I'll try no-tilling. So around June 26th or so, we decided to go out and try and plant it. And it was wet. We mudded it in. And then when it come up, it flooded out. No-till doesn't work. Well, that wasn't a very good experiment. So when you do your experimentation, contact your NRCS personnel. Talk to your SDSU Extension Service. They're the folks that can help you with that. And never be afraid to try something new.
One of the things that came across as most powerful to me is when he talks about how to go about making a change, or even how to go about trying something new in general. Absolutely. You don't need to overhaul your entire operation overnight. You can start small.
Yeah. Start small was his advice, and I'm just going to repeat what he said. Start small and then do it right. It's no use doing something in a half-hearted way. You want to do it to see if you can make it work. So yeah, that was great advice. And I think we need to keep an eye out on Jesse. He's such an innovator.
Yeah, definitely. He's got some goats out there, not just livestock out on his land.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun with the goats.
Hey, Buzz, was there anything specific that stood out to you outside of that starting small approach?
Well, I just think also just his experience with SDSU was really valuable. Also his journey. If you listen carefully, he started out as a skeptic with all this stuff. Remember, they were straight-up corn soybean farmers, and now they're doing all sorts of different things.
Yeah, which is always good to hear, because you know, a lot of the farmers I'm sure listening to this and a lot of the farmers out there that we're trying to reach and get in touch with are where Jesse was. So it's not that Jesse grew up in this way of farming, and now he's talking about it. He came from the traditional way,
right?
And now he's made that transition.
Yep.
Buzz, when you guys were out there, I think I recall you saying that Jesse was collaborating with someone on livestock. Who was that?
Yeah, guy's name is Jim Finnegan, and Jim is a goat guru. and Jim actually introduced Jesse to livestock. Jim's also an NRCS district conservationist from the next county over, I believe. And these two guys collaborate quite a lot.
Okay, very cool. It's always nice to be able to partner up with someone like that. I'm sure that's helped Jesse along the way as he's made these changes.
Yeah. I like his bucket of oats story. So yeah, he's got some good stuff.
That'll wrap it up for us. I am Barrett Self alongside Buzz Clute. Thank you guys for checking us out. Stay tuned.